scientificblogging.com's first part in a series of regular interviews and profiles of women in science. Today we're sitting down with Professor Meg Urey, the Israel Munson Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Yale University. Professor Urey is also the first woman chair of the physics department at Yale. Her scientific research focuses on supermassive black holes in galaxies, and before coming to Yale in 2001, she held a tenured position on the senior scientific staff at the Space Telescope Science Institute, which runs the Hubble Space Telescope for NASA. Professor Urey has been an author on over 140 articles in peer-reviewed journals, and she has also written extensively on the subject of women in science. These writings include her opinion piece in the Washington Post entitled, "Diminished by Discrimination We Scarcely See," and her most recent work on this subject is her chapter in the book, "Gendered Innovations in Science and Engineering," called, "Protons Have No Gender, A Woman's View of Physics." Let's begin. In 2002, that article, Physics for Women, The Last Frontier, you say that no matter how many women start out in physics, there seems to be relatively fewer of them going from undergrad to postgrad and permanent positions.
Mm-hmm.
Has that changed since you wrote that paper in the last 6 years? How has it changed? And why do you think that it's the case that there are so few of them actually going on from starting out in physics?
Yeah, okay. So for all sciences, the fraction of scientists who are women decreases as you go up in the hierarchy. So if you start at, you know, in high school, who's taking science, and then you go to college, who's majoring in science, and then you go to graduate school, who's entering graduate school, and then you ask who's professors and so on. At every level, the fraction of women in any one field is decreasing. But what has happened more recently is that there's some stabilizing, and also where the big drop is different for different fields. For example, in physics, the big drop is really in college. In high school, as many the classes are almost 50-50 girls and boys now in physics in high school. But when you get to college, only about 20% of the majors, physics majors, are women.
And is that true for other sciences?
No, not at all. In fact, in biology, women are more than half now in college. And even in PhDs, they're approaching, it's about half the PhDs in biology go to women.
Okay.
So in biology, the big drop happens after the postdoc years, or in or about the postdoc years. The fraction of faculty who are being hired in biology is low. It's of order, well, it depends on institution, but, you know, it's more like 20%, whereas 50% of the PhDs have gone to women. And the same is true of chemistry. In chemistry, over a third of the PhDs are going to women for the last decade, really, and fewer than 10% of the assistant professors hired are women. So for chemistry and biology, the big gap, and it's a huge gap, is happening, you know, for the people who've really made it through all the hard parts, if you like. In physics, something else seems to be happening. We seem to be really turning people off physics in college. And then, you know, the people who make it through that, who either like the way it's presented in their college classes and or can survive it, even if they don't like it, they do reasonably well. That is, they go to graduate school and they seem to graduate in approximately the same, not quite as high numbers. I guess there's still a little bit of a drop there. That is, if they're 20% majors, then maybe there are 15% PhDs going to women in physics. But then the women who are hired to assistant professors and who are promoted to tenure and so on, that seems to be okay. In the sense that, well, of course, this is the catch-22 of this business. You know, the numbers are so small that you don't really have good statistical significance.
Right.
It's a little hard to tell, but it looks as if there isn't hugely different attrition there, the way there is, for example, for biologists.
So what's going on in the middle? Because at the very top end, you say it's okay, and in the high school level, it's about 50-50, so what's happening in between?
Yeah, and let me give you one more data point before I try an explanation. If you look at astronomy, astronomy has most of the same, you need most of the same physics background in college. So you take many of the same classes, if not entirely the same classes, but you're studying, but the subject is slightly different, and the department is different, usually, or the professors are different. And the fraction of astronomers who are women is roughly double the fraction of physicists who are women at every level. So, for example, 20% of the physics majors are women. It's about 40%. Maybe it's more than half now of the astronomy majors. And so on and so forth. The number of women in astronomy has just exploded, and I really feel we hit some kind of tipping point in, you know, maybe around 2000, where when I organized the first Women in Astronomy meeting, there was a lot of resistance and a lot of well, resistance is a good word. You know, people say, well, why do we need this? We don't really have a problem. And sure, there were no women at that meeting, but that's because there aren't any women who do anything in that field, and there's nobody to invite to give a talk because there aren't any good women, yada, yada. And now, you know, 2008, first of all, whenever you go to an astronomy meeting, it's absolutely packed with women, especially young women. There's half the people there are women. Half the speakers are women. It's extremely unusual to go to a meeting where there aren't women speakers. Still happens, but it's very unusual. And in physics, physics to me today looks like astronomy looked about 20 years ago. It's there's a lot of resistance. There's lip service paid to, yes, yes, we want more women and more minorities. But nobody seems to understand that something has to change. I mean, if you keep running, you know, if your departments and processes and everything stays the same, why would you expect that anything would change? So it's as if people say things like, "Well, women aren't interested in physics. Women want to help people, so they go into the medical sciences. And in fact, women are more than half the medical students now. They still aren't being hired onto medical faculties. By the way, that's the same as biology. They're way more than half the they're more than half the pool, but the ones who get hired onto faculties, predominantly men, by a huge margin, especially in certain subspecialties like surgery, or the really elite subspecialties are very male-dominated. So I think partly people come up with hypotheses to explain this stuff, and there's a long history of you know, every person, and Meg Urey could be another one, offering their ideas for why things are the way they are. And my feeling about this is, first of all, there's no one answer. There are many different effects happening. And I can tell you what I think are the most important. But I think what's really interesting is that sociologists and psychologists have actually done a lot of research in these areas. And What they find is contrary to what many scientists think. Scientists are really good at coming up with hypotheses. So when you discuss with your colleagues that there seem to be very few women in this field, even fewer minorities, they come up with reasons that, like, you know, okay, well, maybe it's this or maybe it's that. And the thing is that you can test those ideas against the data. So, for example, people might say, well, the reason there are no women in physics is because, you know, to succeed, to go through graduate school or become a young faculty member happens during the years when you should be having a family. Women want to have families, and they don't think they can do both, so they don't go into physics. And I say, well, that's really interesting, but, you know, there are lots and lots of women in medical school, and medical school is quite grueling by all accounts. And they have families. So how, you know, that's demonstrably not a good reason, because there are plenty of professions that demand a lot of their practitioners, and women are numerous in those professions. So there's a lot of things like that I think we can, I think we can rule out a lot of these things. So but let's take them on one by one. So, for example, what about the statement that women just aren't interested in physics? So, again, many answers to this. One is, if indeed women want to help others, we should be telling our physics students about how powerful it is to understand physics and the leverage you have to help the world. I had a graduate student come in and talk to me at the beginning of last year. She was actually a new graduate student, this young woman, and I asked her how things are going, and she said, "Well, it's going well, but you know, I'm not sure I'm going to do this. I'm not sure I'm going to stick it out." And I said, she'd been there like 2 weeks. So I said, "Well, why?" She said, "Well, I spent last summer working with an NGO in South America and helping poverty-stricken areas, and I just think that's really important." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "So, you know, I think I should be doing that instead of doing physics." So I said, "Look, lots of people can do what you did last summer, but it's not easy for most people to become physicists. And yet, if you're a physicist, think of all the things you can do to help areas like that, people like that, in ways that are, you know, go well beyond handouts. For example, the $100 laptop. That's a design issue that somebody with physics skills could actually work on, and that could make a major difference in the lives of people in the developing world. And somehow we've created this myth that doing science in American universities, and physics probably like the worst example, is an elite sort of ivory tower profession where you're pondering questions that don't have any real practical applications in the real world, and it's all about solving problems and, you know, being clever. And I think it's the wrong image. I mean, as I tried to tell this young woman, I think you have to look at it as a tool, and I think a physics training is better than almost any other thing you can think of for helping other people. Maybe medicine is a good is in the same league, but if women want to help people, that's no reason they shouldn't go into physics. So that's one of the myths. Another one is that they don't have the skills, they don't have the math skills to do it. That's demonstrably false in many ways. One of which is the thing I told you about, that in high school they take just as much math and physics and they do just as well. It's also true that the so-called math gap in performance is illusory. It's shrinking. It's poorly measured. And, I mean, that's a whole other topic, but it isn't true. So women certainly have the skills. And maybe a third comment about women don't want to do physics is that, in fact, what I've observed in my 25 years in the field is that there are lots of young women who are really excited about physics, who just love it. They love working in the lab. They love doing physics homework, believe it or not. They love the whole thing. And you find that particularly among undergraduates, and you find it in first-year graduate students. But if you start talking to senior graduate students, you find a very different picture. You find people who have lost their confidence and they've lost their interest. And they describe it in very personal terms as if they are they are at fault. They'll say things like, "Well, you know, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have gone into this field. I'm not good enough for it. I can't do it. I don't have any good ideas. I'm no good at it." And then when you talk to people who know them, it turns out that in fact, these women are doing very well, that they're highly respected, but the view they have of themselves is quite low. And so my personal interpretation of what happens is that that we go out of our way to discourage people from pursuing physics, and even when people persist, we pretty much tell everybody they're not smart enough. I think this is true in other fields. I recognize this now from my father was a chemist, and he used to tell stories about his lab and his students and so on, which I now realize fit this mold of a kind of a trial by fire, where you haze students in order to discover who among them has the backbone, an be a great scientist. And so, you know, for my father's generation, certainly, and this happened to him, actually, you know, if somebody said to him, you aren't good enough, you have to go do something else, the correct response, which was his response, was, well, yes, I am, and I'm going to do it, and I'm going to succeed. And yet, the response, for someone like me, or many women I know, the response would be, oh, you think I'm not good enough. Okay, I guess I'm not, and I'll have to think about what else I'm going to do with my life. So what I think happens is that the pressure and sort of elitist talk about, you know, how very few people are really worthy and so on, all of that acts differently on men and on women. Sociologists tell us that men, on average, tend to have overinflated ideas of their abilities and their prospects, and women tend to have lower than average ideas of their abilities and their prospects, at least after they've reached some age, you know, immersed in our culture. And so you end up with, say, a set of graduate students about to finish their theses who the men think the world is their oyster and that this piece of work they've done is brilliant and they're ready to hit the road, and the women think their work is substandard and they better find another occupation. And I think, so it just acts differentially on the two genders. And there are a couple other things that also reinforce that, I think, all of which are societal norms. In our society, men are supposed to work, make money, and support a family. And at a minimum, support themselves, but certainly in many cases do more. Women now, you know, 40 years after the women's lib movement, 80 years after they got the franchise to vote, women are, you know, it isn't crazy for them to have a career, but it's always seen as sort of a optional activity. And in fact, women are praised and reinforced when they quit their jobs and stay home to raise a family. And it seems to me from reading, you know, just reading the newspaper, the more exalted the position the woman occupied, the greater the praise when she gives it up. So if some high-powered lawyer or businesswoman decides to take a break and stay home with the kids, that's seen as a really selfless and honorable choice. If a man did that, it would be seen as slightly odd. You know, what's wrong with him that he's not taking care of his family? Isn't he kind of wussy to do that? So I think those societal pressures sort of push women off the science highway and keep men on the science highway. Men, I think maybe, they may have many of the same self-doubts and concerns about their future, but they just don't dare think about it, because they don't, for most men, you don't have the option to not work. It wouldn't be acceptable, or it's really scary or whatever. So men are kind of less prone to self-examination about their worthiness in the particular endeavor they've chosen to follow, whereas women are just constantly wondering, gee, am I good enough? Should I be doing this? Maybe I should be doing something else. And so, you know, all those things kind of have a pressure on women.
In your paper from 2002, you say that in physics, something's happening that's not happening maybe in equally demanding science fields, like you've just said, with medicine and biology and chemistry. So what's going on in physics? Why is it specifically physics, maybe engineering, technology? Why is it those sort of things where we're noticing these problems?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because it's funny, the fraction of women is so different among the different topics of science, subfields of science. And also, let me just say, it's also different from country to country. So if you ask what's the fraction of physicists who are women, it's vastly different in different countries. And so right off the bat, I think the comment you just made about similar skills being needed in other fields and the idea that they're very different from country to country just tells you that it's some kind of cultural phenomenon rather than a you know, really materially based. I mean, there's no real reason for it. My guess in physics, well, is colored by my own perception. I mean, and others may have a different, you know, may have different ideas, but it seems to me, my hypothesis, which so far has stood the test of time, is that the more elitist the field, the fewer the women. So fields that talk about themselves, you know, where the language is about how rarefied the very best people are, how few of them there are, those fields have fewer women than fields where you're just doing a job and it's, you know, hey, good job over there, you know, where it's not so hierarchical. And I recently learned, in fact, I met this woman giving a talk at Brookhaven. She and I both gave talks. There was a, this is last May, there's a collaboration meeting of an experiment that runs at the Brookhaven National Laboratory. And she and I gave these talks. And this woman, Laurel, her name is Laurel Smith Dewar, D-O-E-R-R, it's hyphenated, Smith Dewar. Her research, she's a sociologist, and she does research on gender bias as a function of hierarchy, of organizational structure. And she finds that the more hierarchical the organization, the greater the gender disparities. So organizations that have very strict hierarchies, that have many levels, they're much less likely to have women at top levels. Whereas companies where, that are relatively flat, women are, can be much more successful. Go back to the general picture. If on average men overrate their abilities and women underrate their abilities, then you can imagine how elitist talk operates on that. It reinforces the guy's need to brag, and it reinforces the women's tendency to think they aren't good enough. And in fact, you know, frequently women think they're not good enough. But if you try to look at objective data on that, for example, there's work by Elaine Seymour and Nancy Hewitt have done a number of studies on undergraduates who declare science majors when they enter college. And they follow them through the 4 years, and they do interviews with them, and they try to find out why they do or don't major in science. And you find out that, okay, sorry, one more fact, and that is professors, so people in my position who are teaching young people and presumably nurturing their future success, professors, on average, think that the best students are the ones who major in their field. So physicists think that, you know, well, the really good students will major in physics. And it doesn't matter how I treat them in class or what I teach them. If they were any good, they'd major in physics and they'd do well. And what Seymour and Hewitt showed in their research is that, in fact, the people who leave science are doing just as well as the people who stay. Their grades were just as good. There's no, you know, it's not true that the smartest people stay in science, and, or at least not in physics or whatever. So we're fooling ourselves, thinking we're getting the cream of the crop. What we're really doing is chasing away really bright people because we for many reasons, probably also because we teach in a boring way, but you know, at least in part because we have this sort of only 3% of you are worthy, and we don't care about the rest of you. So that kind of elitism really, I think, really does a job on the participation of women. And women are much more likely to go to areas where they see other women.
One of the things you've also said is you think that women need a better understanding of the issues involving hiring, funding, promotion, and stuff like that. Do you think, first of all, that men have a better grasp of that because of what they're taught in these fields, and I guess more importantly, if women do need a better grasp of hiring, funding, and promotion, how do you suggest that they go out and do that?
Yeah, really good point. Really good point. I think in general, women go through the system as outsiders. They get less mentoring and less. There's less information flow because they are the other. And men are much more likely to get mentored informally. I mean, it's not formal at all, but if the faculty are 95% male, which is true in physics, then, well, let me back up. I think it's easiest to talk to somebody and relate to somebody who's like you. There's no question about it. You know, if somebody comes from your background or thinks or talks the way you do or likes the things you do, you have a rapport and you like talking to them. And I notice, for example, when students come to talk to me, if they're anything like me, if they grew up in a family like I did or whatever, it's easy for me to think that I know what they're thinking. That is, if I'm going to offer advice, it's easier because I think I have a good shot at understanding what they're thinking about their options or, you know. But if it's somebody who comes from a completely different background or setting or whatever, it's much harder for me to offer advice or to talk to them because I don't know where they're coming from. So if all the faculty are male, then it's not surprising. You know, a typical faculty member will get some great rapport with some young student, but it's harder for the young women students to get that rapport with a faculty member, I think, than it is for the young men. I mean, there's always going to be people who violate those generalities, but I think what happens for the guys is they just have a sort of a better conduit to how things work and how the game is played, and so they pick it up faster. Not everybody, and there certainly are some women who are, you know, masterful at it, but I think it's, on the whole, the amount of mentoring is very different. So for young women who find themselves in that position where they're kind of the outsider, and I've seen it just countless times in my own field, I think they have to recognize that that's the case, that there's a set of information that they're not naturally going to get, and they have to go out and seek it. And as I say, for many young men, maybe that isn't necessary. They don't have to seek it out. It just comes naturally. But for women, they may be more likely to have to seek it out. And then I think the advice I give young women is, you know, find yourself a bunch of mentors. First of all, you know, people at your level, peers, other people who are postdocs or faculty, whatever you are. And also, you know, go to these older guys and more or less force them to mentor you. You don't have to put it in those terms, but, you know, ask to have lunch with them to kind of talk over what your prospects are or what some experiment was like. Or, you know, make that step to build bridges where, you know, it might be more natural or easier not to do it. I think that's really critical because otherwise if you are an outsider, the way science runs in the U.S. anyway, you really can't succeed. You just can't. I mean, in order to do your work, you need support. You need to be supported by a university. You need to be supported by a federal funding agency. Many of those decisions are made by your colleagues, you know, a hiring committee at a university or a proposal review committee at the NIH or at the NSF, and they have to decide you're worthy. So you have to be networked in. If you aren't, you can't succeed. The first thing women should do is find other women in their situation. So if you're at a sizable university, you have that on your campus. If you're at a small place, or like where I went, where there were 5 physics majors a year, you might not have another physicist, young woman physicist at your institution. So you need to find those people. And usually, you know, there are organizations within institutions, so within universities or within companies, there are organizations, and also within professions. I think every scientific field has a professional society, sometimes more than one. So there's the American Chemical Society, there's the American Physical Society, there's the American Astronomical Society, etc. And every one of those societies has a committee on the status of women. I don't think there's a single one that doesn't. Pretty much everybody's got one, and those groups are can be very helpful. With the internet, everybody's got a website, everybody's got information on the web, and then there's a kind of a canon now of major references, and part of this is due to, so the National Science Foundation, I think, has really made a huge difference for women in science in several ways, but one of the key ways is they run a program called the Advance Program, which over the last 8 years has funded institutions to transform themselves with respect to women in science. They didn't specify how it should be done. They asked for proposals, they ranked the proposals, and then they funded, they've now funded about 30 of these places. And if you look across the U.S., those institutions have made major, major progress in understanding what the barriers are to women in science and in breaking down those barriers. Just to take one example, the University of Michigan is an advanced site, and they... Well, they do many different things, but they've made tremendous inroads. They've educated faculty about gender bias, which I think is a major issue. I guess they haven't talked about it at all. I think gender bias is very much present in our daily lives, including our academic lives for people like me on the faculty. And it's pretty much unrecognized. It was a really great experiment I read about a year ago. So is that typical psychology experiment? You first of all, you run it on undergraduates because they have to do experiments when they take your course, and you show them a bunch of resumes and you ask them to rank the resumes for some job. So this particular experiment was looking at hiring people to be a police chief. And before you saw the resume, they gave you a list of, I don't know, 20 or 30 qualities, and you were asked to say which were the most important qualities for being a police chief. And, you know, there were things like previous experience as a police officer, physical fitness, and so things like that. And then there were other qualities that might be more maybe for some other profession like nursing, because they also did an experiment on nursing, things like being a caring person, having raised a family, or, you know, things like that. Okay, so you pick out the things you think are important. Then they show you the resumes, and you rank them. And this was, of course, repeated many times with many experimental conditions. But what you find is if the candidates are all men, then the resume that that had the most of these qualities people said were important was ranked first. If the candidates were mixed between men and women, but the man's resume had these qualities people had prioritized as important, then that guy would be ranked number one. But if the woman, if a resume with those qualities had the woman's name on it, and there were men's names on other resumes with less of those qualities, they would not pick her. They would pick some man, and he would be the priority. And what was most interesting, the reason I told this whole long story, is because one of the first questions they were asked, again, before they saw the resumes, they were asked to write down whether they thought they were objective. And the people who said, yes, I'm objective, those were the people who changed the criteria, who would not rank the woman first, even when she had all the qualities they had said they were looking for. Whereas the people who checked off that they thought they were biased didn't change their criteria, and they actually would have ranked the woman first. So what's really interesting is, and I think the reason is this, if we can imagine that we're biased, if we admit that we're biased, then we try very hard, you know, to compensate for that bias and to be objective and to use objective criteria. But if we are quite convinced we aren't biased, then we just don't think about criteria, and we just say, oh, I know that guy's the best for the job. You know, I'm sure. And we don't need to articulate why, because we're sure we're unbiased, and therefore, you know, it must be right. And the analogy to what we've been talking about is that, you know, in my profession, in science in general, being objective is one of the most important qualities you can have, because, you know, you have to be objective as a scientist. It's a core value. And so most of us really don't want to admit we're not objective. It's very difficult. And in fact, many of my colleagues tell me that they're perfectly objective with respect to gender. And as soon as they say that, I know they're not, because come on, we're all biased. We all grew up in a society in the U.S. that is very gendered. You know, there's, when I was a kid, there were no women on the Supreme Court. Now you've got one, but you grow up in a world where the leaders are men. You know, we've never had a woman president, on and on. The leaders are men. So it's a very gendered society. We absorb that, we internalize it, and if it didn't have some effect on us, I'd be amazed. But many scientists are very reluctant to admit that, because it's unscientific. And also, in, you know, it doesn't help that we've sort of demonized any trend towards sensitivity. We call it PC, and you know, we make fun of it rather than celebrating it as a polite way for us all to get along. So I think it's hard to make progress on it. I don't know. The most feminist guys I know are ones who are, you know, married to somebody that they're thinking of, or they had a mother, or they have a sister, or a kid. And, you know, what I'm trying to say is, through personal experience, you know, you see the other person's side. I had a young woman once tell me, she was a physics major, this was some years ago, at another university, but she said she was really interested in physics and she wanted to go on, but did I think she could have a family and do physics? And the first thing I said was, well, gee, you know, every physicist I know has a family, or pretty much everyone, so why shouldn't you be able to? She said, yeah, but, you know, who's going to take care of the kids? My boyfriend thinks that I should go to graduate school wherever he gets in, because he's more important. And I just looked at her and I said, okay, well, the first thing you have to do is dump him. Which she didn't think was very funny, but in a way I was very serious. I mean, of course, I didn't know him and I didn't know her, so it was ridiculous. But if you have that kind of relationship where one of you is more important than the other one, then no, I don't think you can have a career and a family.
Well, yeah,
you know, I have been asked so many times by women, can I do physics and have a family? I have never once been asked that by a young man, ever. You know, it just doesn't, it's not a question for men. And I can think of lots of ways in which our stereotypes feed that. First of all, there's the issue of expectations. So I think we tend to have lower expectations of women as leaders than of men. So if you have a woman and a man and you're thinking about promoting them and they're both young, you might think, yeah, I think this guy can do it. But you might think, well, let's let her spend a few more years learning the ropes and then see about it.
Yeah.
Because I think people just don't have that leap of faith that women are going to excel.
Yeah.
And then I also think in academia there's an interesting, well, of course, we have the tenure system, which I think warps people's behavior. And I have seen many cases, of course, most academics are men, so it's a little hard to say things statistically, but most men seem to follow a sort of sprint and fade trajectory. So they just turn on the afterburners their first years as an assistant professor and, you know, do everything, go to every meeting and try to make a huge splash, and then they get tenure and then they vanish. And I've seen that happen a number of times. People who were seen as extraordinarily important, promising, big stars, just kind of, they don't, you know, they're not bad, they just kind of fade. And I don't see that with the women. I see women as having a more sustained output. They're not as flashy to start with, and that may even be in my perception that they're not. But they don't stop. I've never seen a woman get tenure and stop. And I think part of what's going on is that women don't really get the system very well. They don't know the rules as well as the guys. That's what we talked about before. And so for them, it's about the work. It's about, okay, I'm interested in this problem, I'm going to solve this problem, and then I'm going to do that problem, and so on. It's kind of all about the work, whereas for men, it's about the touchdown, you know, get over the tenure goal line.
Do you think it has anything to do with women, even after they've been tenured, that it's an issue of, like, they still continually have to prove themselves all the time, whereas men are kind of like, all right, I've got the touchdown, everyone knows I'm good?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I suspect that among scientists, nobody ever really feels satisfied that they're... I mean, we all have self-doubt, and there's always another hurdle, like, okay, maybe it was tenure, but now it's, you know, getting elected to fellowship in your professional society, or maybe it's getting elected to the National Academy, or there's always something ahead, another thing to reach for. But I do think in general women have more self-doubt than men, or at least they're more, they act on it more. And I think that's just part of the, you know, if you look around and there's no women around, you kind of get the message you don't belong. And so you can't help but be affected by that. I think the young guys who get supported and promoted by their peers, they have less reason to wonder if they belong, and they spend less time thinking about it.